You know, it was 1859 when Charles Darwin wrote his famous book On the Origin of Species, and we're still talking about it today. It was controversial then, it's controversial now. Did you know that Charles Darwin waited 20 years before he even published his book? Because he knew deep down that people were going to be offended by it, upset by it, that it was going to call into question many deeply held religious beliefs. And he was right, because we are still arguing over it, and one of the biggest arguments takes place in our public schools. And the question is, can we teach evolution in schools? Should we teach it in schools? Or what about this closely related concept of intelligent design? We're going to talk all about it today, and we're going to talk about the most famous case in this area, Dover versus Kitzmiller. Stick around.
Your weekly Constitutional is produced at WETS-FM in cooperation with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
Our topic today, it's a very smart topic, intelligent design.
More than 80 years after the Scopes trial, creationism is alive and well. Through local school boards, sympathetic politicians, and well-funded organizations, a strong movement has developed to encourage the teaching of the latest incarnation of creationism, intelligent design, as a scientifically credible theory alongside evolution in science classes.
I personally don't believe in Darwin's theory of evolution.
I thought that was the funniest thing I'd heard. I mean, creationism was ruled out as public education in science when I was in junior high school.
I've never appreciated the fact that my children are being taught to believe in evolution as opposed to creationism.
Saying that you don't believe in evolution is almost saying for us, well, we don't believe that the Civil War ever took place in the United States.
When I look around at the complexity and beauty of our world, I wonder how anyone could think it happened without a designer.
These mechanisms are just that, mindless material mechanisms that do what they do, irrespective of intelligence. To be sure, mechanisms can be programmed by an intelligence, but any such intelligent programming of evolutionary mechanisms is not properly part of evolutionary biology.
In the beginning, God created. To me, that's all I need to know.
The problem is, if you look for what is intelligent, and yeah, you can find some things that are just really beautiful, and really, hey, that's clever. A lot of things you can point to, but then you stop looking at all the things that confound that revelation.
Secular scientists often mock the simple faith of those who believe in an unseen God. But statisticians say the odds are impossible this incredibly intricate, elegant code could ever just evolve.
There is no scientific debate about evolution versus intelligent design. There is a debate, but it's a political debate. And it's a debate about whether something that is not really science should be taught in science class.
Intelligent design. You might not have heard about this for a few years, but just a few years ago, it was very much in the news. And you never know with constitutional issues when it's going to crop up again. Here to discuss it with me today is an expert on this subject, a fellow who litigated probably the most prominent intelligent design case in history. His name is Eric Rothschild, and he's from the law firm of Pepper Hamilton, LLP in Philadelphia. We'll be talking to Eric in a few minutes, but in the meantime, another expert, my student, Jason Grace from the Appalachian School of Law. He's going to give us the necessary background so we can understand this very smart topic. Jason, how you doing?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. Now, where are you from? You have one of those accents that suggest to me, oh, I don't know, Southern gentility.
Well, I don't know about that. Professor Harris, thank you again for having me. I'm from Big Stone Gap, Virginia, which is a couple hours across the Virginia state line, and I'm a big NPR fan, so I'm just delighted to be with you today.
We're delighted to have you with us today. Well, tell us, Jason, what is this strange thing we call intelligent design?
Well, let's start from the very beginning, Professor Harris. Many years ago, around the beginning of the naturalist movement, a scientist named...
The naturalist movement?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sure you're going to tell us what that was.
Yeah. Well, I certainly will.
Okay.
I certainly will. It was a movement by a group of renowned scientists during the 19th century
okay.
who who decided that they wanted to more critically analyze the origins of complex life in the on the planet, and to test what they considered to be truth and using the scientific method.
Okay.
And a renowned scientist named Charles Robert Darwin.
We might have heard of him.
You may have. And he published a groundbreaking work around this time called On the Origin of Species, and that was published in 1859.
Okay.
And Mr. Darwin argued that all species of life have descended over time from a common ancestry, and he further proposed that the scientific theory that this branching pattern of in the scientific theory that a branching pattern of evolution resulted from a process he called natural selection. And this theory essentially explains the origins of complex life as it evolved from simpler organisms over immense periods of time.
Okay. So we're starting with Charles Darwin and what's been called the theory of evolution.
The theory of evolution, okay. That's right. And so now we're getting a little closer to talking about intelligent design. Because not many years after evolution became a very popular and influential theory in the scientific community, a competing theory arose to evolution. And this competing theory arose from the American Christian community predominantly, but also Christian communities across the planet, and Christian philosophers and thinkers put their heads together to compete this, to put together this competing theory to evolution. It was called creationism and creation science.
Okay, so creationism was simply, probably in its simplest form, was simply a recounting of the Genesis account of creation.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
And that had been around for a long, long time, and had, in fact, had been taught in schools for a long, long time.
Yes.
As schools expanded, and as more and more public schools were expanded in the United States, you had this side-by-side sort of competition between the two. Either you believed in the seven-day creation story, or you believed in evolution over time.
That's correct. Yes, sir.
Okay. So, what was the problem?
Well, the problem is that while evolution had a firm foundation in scientific study and thought, and while it had been tested rigorously, the problem with creationism is that it couldn't be tested along the same using the same mechanism that scientists could use. And so it became problematic to teach this in the same context as a competing theory in the K-12 classroom, taught by biology teachers, for example. This was very problematic.
Okay.
Yeah. And so that naturally leads us to the Scopes trial, the Scopes monkey trial in 1926, mm-hmm. which occurred here in Tennessee.
Yeah, not far from here, just down the road. In fact, quite near Chattanooga, Tennessee, wasn't it?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
Okay, in Dayton, right? Dayton, Tennessee, wasn't it?
That's right.
Okay.
It was in Dayton, Tennessee.
So what was going on there? What was the legal problem?
Well, this case concerned a Tennessee law called the Butler Act, which banned the teaching of evolution in Tennessee public schools.
Wow. Okay. So that's how Tennessee reacted to evolution. They simply said, "We don't like that theory, so we're going to teach creationism exclusively."
Precisely.
In biology classes.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And here, one of the parties was a high school biology teacher, in fact, named John Scopes, and he was criminally charged in this case.
It was a crime to teach evolution.
It was. He was criminally charged, and of course there was a civil contest here over the constitutionality of the Butler Act.
Mm-hmm.
And both the Tennessee Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the Butler Act. It remained in effect. And Mr. Scopes was unfortunately held to have violated the criminal law.
Wait a minute. I've seen Inherit the Wind. I thought that Scopes won.
Scopes actually...
He lost?
He lost.
Wait, he lost the monkey trial. Most people, I think, probably, especially those of us who've seen the movie, think of it as a victory for evolution. That's the way it's portrayed.
Right.
You know, I think Spencer Tracy, didn't he portray the lawyer Clarence Darrow?
as I recall.
I think he did in the movie. Clarence Darrow, of course, was representing Scopes. And then who was the fellow who represented the other side? Was a very prominent lawyer. You remember?
William Jennings
Bryan. Willing Jennings Bryan. Thank you, Wayne. William Jennings Bryan represented the state of Tennessee in that particular case. And it was a great cause celeb. Excuse me. But ultimately, even though it's broadly considered to have been, the testimony in the case is broadly considered to have vindicated the theory of evolution, Scopes actually lost it. Okay, so what happened after the Scopes trial?
Well, as we can see, the Scopes trial got the theory of evolution in the classroom off to a very rocky start in 1926. And there were some other states that emulated Tennessee just after this ruling came out. To be quite specific, the great state of Arkansas in 1928 enacted a similar prohibition against the teaching of evolutionary theory. And so thus we come to the case of Epperson v. Arkansas.
Well, we have to fast forward a little bit.
Right, we do. Okay. And this takes us to 1968. And
okay, so things have changed a little bit between 1928 and 1968. Okay. So what happens in the Epperson case?
That's correct. Well, we have a very similar set of facts to the Scopes trial. We have a question pertaining to whether or not again, evolution can be taught in the public school classroom, and this time the Supreme Court came back a little differently. The statute, let me say at first, was enacted during a period of Christian fundamentalist fervor in the 1920s, as I previously said, and the court found that not only was the state prohibited from advancing or protecting a particular religious view, which this statute was alleged to have done, but also that the state has no legitimate interest in protecting any or all of the religious views, or excuse me, the state has no legitimate interest in protecting any or all religious views, religions from views distasteful to them.
Right. And in fact, let's bring this back to the Constitution. The particular clause that was at issue here was, of course, the so-called Establishment Clause of the First Amendment to the Constitution.
That's correct.
Which states that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion.
That is correct.
And that has been interpreted in the context of public schools, which, of course, are part of the government, to mean that certainly no particular religious viewpoint may be advanced and by the public schools, which are funded by all of us, regardless of our faith or lack of faith. And therefore, the teaching of creationism, which after all is, depending on how it's presented, is the view of only one particular group of religious people, not shared by everybody, is prohibited because that advances that particular view of religion. So not only were they saying that it was okay to teach evolution in school, they were actually going 180 degrees and saying it's not really okay to teach creationism.
That's correct.
So this was the anti-Scopes case. This is what people think that the Scopes monkey trial did, but it actually took 42 years longer until 1968 for it to actually happen in the Epperson case.
That's correct.
Okay. Now we understand Epperson and creationism, as of 1968 anyway, is no longer has a place in the public schools.
Okay. That's right.
Okay. Now, so how does this relate to intelligent design?
Well, that's an interesting question, but we have one more intermediate step before we start to talk about intelligent design and its jurisprudence and its place in the jurisprudence of courts today, and that's the case of Edwards v. Aguilar, and that came down pretty recently from the Supreme Court in 1987, and this case talks predominantly about the validity of creation science and its place in the classroom.
Wait a minute, creation science? We were talking about creationism, but what's
yes.
this new term, creation science?
Well, many argue that creation science was an attempt by the Christian community or advocates of creationism to use the same body of thought with regard to creationism and the teaching of creationism in the classroom, and applying a different name to that same body of thought in hopes that it would withstand the test of constitutional rigor.
So this was just sort of a relabeling. If we add the word science to something, that makes it scientific?
Apparently that's what they were thinking, but that's not what the Supreme Court decided in Edwards here.
So wait a minute. If we called Playboy magazine Playboy Science, would that make it a science magazine? And we could have it in our schools.
That's
we?
An interesting and complicated question, and you might be able to make an argument to get that in the local public library.
But, I see. All right. Well, that's an interesting technique. So they tried to do that effectively. They tried to add the word science to creationism.
That's right.
And did that fly?
No, it did not. If we take a closer look at Edwards, we see that Louisiana, we're talking about Louisiana this time, enacted a statute which essentially mandated equal airtime in the biology classroom to both evolution and creationism. And proponents of the law stated that this was a matter of academic freedom in the classroom. But the Supreme Court said that merely requiring the teaching of two philosophies actually constricted the notion of academic freedom. So it didn't exactly accomplish what the proponents of creation science argued that it would.
Okay, and that was the Edwards case in 1987.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
So as of 1987, we've tamped down we've first of all said evolution is fine to be taught in science class. Creationism is not, nor right. is its closely related cousin creation science.
So that's right.
So that seems to bring things to a halt in 1987, but is that really the end?
Well, it's not. It's not. We have one more case in Kitzmiller v. Dover Area School District, the Dover Area School District.
Okay, but before we get to Kitzmiller, what happened in 1987? What was the new terminology then that came out?
The issue here is intelligent design. This is the new phrase of the creationist movement in America.
Okay, so we've finally gotten to the topic of our show today. So what is this thing called intelligent design?
Well, intelligent design is very similar to creationism, but it has a more secular bent to it, and it essentially states that in the context of complex human life, there has to be a designer of some sort. But we're not exactly saying who that designer is. There's got to be a grand schemer or creator behind the creation of, for example, an eyeball or a heart or a human being.
Simply because these are such complex biological structures that it doesn't make sense that they could have come together gradually.
Even. Exactly.
Yeah, okay. In fact, the metaphor I've often heard used to explain this is that if you're walking along a beach and you see a seashell, that's one thing. But if you happen to see a wristwatch or a pocket watch or something really, really complicated that would require planning and intricate assembly and all the rest of it, that you can very reasonably infer that somebody intelligent created that wristwatch. And in much the same fashion, if you encounter something that's infinitely more complex as a human being, that for heaven's sake, somebody had to have created it.
That's the gist of it, yes.
Okay, that's the gist of it. But again, as you said, we don't say who might have done this.
Right.
We leave that part open.
Exactly. And you know, that the more non-specific design of intelligent design and the philosophy of it is designed to make it more palatable for the non-Christian community in America.
Okay, so this starts to make its way into the schools, and it's challenged eventually, right?
That's correct. In 2005, we have the case of Kitzmiller v. Dover Area School District, and this is a Pennsylvania case. This was a district court case that's very recent. It expresses the sense also that intelligent design is part and parcel of creationism, and that it similarly has no place being placed in the classroom.
Okay, what was the factual background of Kitzmiller? What happened there?
Okay, here
actually it's typically called the Dover case. So what happened in the Dover case?
Okay. In the Dover case, the plaintiffs successfully argued, as I said, that intelligent design is a form of creationism. The school board violated the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. And here, 11 parents of students in Dover, Pennsylvania, over the school board requirement that a statement promoting intelligent design was to be read aloud in ninth grade science classes when evolution was taught, they argued against this mandate. And
were these all a bunch of atheist parents? Is that who they were?
No, they were a very diverse selection, cross-section of plaintiffs here. Mm-hmm. And these plaintiffs came from all different backgrounds. You had atheists and you had Christians that each stated, who each believed that teaching intelligent design in the biology classroom and the biology curriculum didn't have the same place that evolution did because it didn't have the same foundation in science.
Right. In fact, let's be a little more specific about this. There are essentially two objections to intelligent design or creationism. And that is, number one, and perhaps most fundamentally, it's not science.
That's
you can call it creation science, you can call it intelligent design, but even if it's true, it doesn't lead anywhere. So because if you simply look at a human being and say, well, we're not going to study how it came about, we're not going to try to figure out how it came about, we're simply going to say, well, God did that.
Right.
Well, that kind of ends the discussion. There's nothing to study.
Right.
It's a matter of faith. And faith is fine, and people,
right.
The First Amendment also protects our freedom to believe that, but it's not science because it doesn't lead to testable theories.
Right.
It doesn't lead to further knowledge.
And let's not misstate the holding of Edwards here. The High Court didn't exactly say that creationism and intelligent design has absolutely no place in any curriculum. It carved out biology and science as an exception and said that can't be put on the same pedestal as evolution in the biology.
It's not science.
And
I'm glad you pointed that out, because going all the way back to Edwards in 1987, the court has said that if you want to teach about religion in schools,
right.
If you want to have a course that, world religions and creationism is one of the concepts you talk about, that's great. That's fabulous.
Right.
It's an important subject. But teaching it as science misstates it, and it does. It puts it into a different category than all other religious beliefs, and therefore it's pushing one particular religious viewpoint on, a captive audience of school-age public school children.
Right.
But the other problem, of course, with creationism and with intelligent design is the religious aspect. It's not just that it's not science, it is religion, it's positive religion, and that's where the Establishment Clause comes in.
Precisely, and that's exactly what Justice Brennan noted in his majority opinion in Edwards. He said that teaching a variety of scientific theories about the origins of humankind to schoolchildren might be validly done with the clear secular intent of enhancing the effectiveness of scientific instruction, but he's saying there you can't be expressing a non-secular religious purpose in the classroom and make that as your, making the indoctrination of kids as your primary purpose behind, voicing that theory.
Well, Jason, that was a very thorough introduction to this very complicated topic, and I thank you very much.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I've been speaking with my student, Jason Grace, about evolution versus intelligent design. He's been giving us some background. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then very soon, we'll be talking to a lawyer who's litigated the most famous case ever in this area. His name is Eric Rothschild. Stay tuned.
A long time ago, when the earth was green, and there was more kinds of animals than you'd ever seen, they'd run around free while the earth was being born. But the loveliest of them all was the unicorn. There was green alligators and long-necked geese, some humpty backcamas and some chimpanzees, some cats and rats and elephants, but sure as you're born, the loveliest of all was the unicorn.
Well, it's time again for our constitutional quiz, and with me in the studio is Doug Smith, also known as
the Riddler. What riddle do you have for us today, Doug?
Oh, I've got a good one, Stuart. Okay. So, here's the riddle. It's a presidential city. Okay?
Okay.
I'm a city named for a U.S. president, but I'm located far from his birthplace. My coast shares an ocean with America, and it hosted the Middle Passage. But I'm not in North America. What city am I?
Are you at least going to give this poor man some answer choices?
I will. I'll give four choices.
All right.
A, Obamaville, Kenya. B, Harrison, France. C, Garfield, Australia. Or D, Monrovia, Liberia.
All right. Four choices. Well, I guess I should confirm, do we have a man on the line?
We do.
And who is this man?
I'm Chris. I'm from Abingdon, Virginia.
From Abingdon, Virginia. Do you listen to us in WEHC out of Emory and Henry or WETS out of Johnson City?
I listen to WETS.
I see both fine stations that you can listen to in Abingdon. So did you hear the choices you've got, or do you need to hear them again?
I heard them, and I believe I can go with D, Monrovia.
You sound pretty certain.
I'm about 99% certain here.
Well, what's your reasoning here before we go back to the quiz guy?
Well, we got the Middle Passage, okay?
What's the Middle Passage?
Well, that's a reference to the slave trade, if memory serves. The west coast of Africa was active during those times, and Liberia being on the west coast of Africa would be put us right there where we need to be for this answer. So I'm going to go with Monrovia.
Oh, was that? I got that. Apparently, that's his final choice. Doug, how did he do?
He, you know what? There must be something about Abingdon, Virginia. People coming out of Abingdon are brilliant.
Is that what it is?
It is. Monrovia, it is. It's named after James Monroe, who was a supporter of the American Colonization Society. And mm-hmm. So what they were doing was they were repatriating freed slaves back to Africa. It's quite a controversial notion, to be honest with you.
Indeed it is, but it's kind of interesting you should mention that. I actually have a student right now who is from Liberia, and I'm going to be interviewing her on the show before too long, at least if she'll let me. But that's a very interesting and controversial history.
It brought some curious people together. You had Quakers, of course, who were amazing abolitionists. But it also brought them together with some slaveholders and some former slaveholders who were really concerned that freed slaves in the new America might lead to uprisings and revolts. And so while there was some on the compassionate side, there were also some on the expedient side. And I think historians will fight this out over generations.
Indeed they will. But of course, the important thing is that Chris won a T-shirt.
Hey!
So congratulations, Chris.
Thank you very much, Mr. Harris.
All right, and thanks very much for playing. We appreciate your time.
All right, well, thanks again. Bye.
Hey, it's the Constitution, Stuart. I read it for the article.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Here with us now is Eric Rothschild. He is a partner at the very prestigious Philadelphia law firm of Pepper Hamilton, LLP. And Eric was the co-lead counsel in the Kitzmiller versus Dover Area School District case, the first case in the nation to test whether intelligent design can be introduced into the curriculum of public high school science classes. So how did you come to get involved, or how did intelligent design crop up there in Pennsylvania, and how did you get involved in it?
So to answer the question about how it cropped up, there was a school board in Dover, Pennsylvania, that's near York and Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, which was looking for an alternative to Darwin's theory of evolution. They didn't want to only teach the theory of evolution. They talked in board meetings in June 2004 about presenting creationism, and then eventually their language gravitated with some outside influences to intelligent design and an intelligent design textbook called Of Pandas and People. And so they adopted that textbook, and then in October of 2004 changed the biology curriculum so that students would be presented intelligent design as an alternative to Darwin's theory. And that's when my law firm, Pepper Hamilton, became involved. There were parents who were calling the ACLU, complaining about this change to the biology curriculum. The ACLU needed a private law firm to work with to bring what would be a pretty substantial case. And I had previously been connected to a group of lawyers who had sort of been monitoring these evolution issues throughout the country, and through that connection, my firm joined up with the ACLU. We did this as part of our pro bono public interest program, and our firm, the ACLU, and Americans United for Separation of Church and State teamed up to represent a group of parents who wanted to challenge this policy.
Well, that's very impressive, because your time ain't cheap. And so that's...
And I can't do that much public interest work every year, because you're right, we have to pay the bills here, but the firm was very supportive.
Okay. Well, so the firm and you decided you could take this case, and then what happened next?
So that... You know, that set in motion what happens in really every piece of litigation, where we started taking evidence from the school board, school administration, developing experts who would testify about the case. And we brought this case, you know, by complaint in December of 2004, and by September 2005, we were going to trial, which is a pretty rapid schedule in the federal courts for a case, you know, that was, you know, this important and this impactful.
That's a remarkably quick schedule, so you must have been working around the clock on it there.
I was, and many colleagues, both at Pepper and at our co-counsel organizations.
Well, your theory was that, of course, this was simply a creationism in disguise.
It was creationism in disguise, non-scientific, and really an effort by the board to impose their particular religious views on the student body in general.
Okay, and then what was the defense's response to that?
I think there were two, you know, sort of key propositions for the defense. One is, this is no big deal. All we're doing is making them aware. And, you know, to be fair to the defense, they weren't, you know, teaching days and days about intelligent design. They were simply presenting intelligent design as a competing theory to evolution in a sort of four-paragraph statement. So one part of it was, it's just not that big a deal. The second part of it, and I think the more substantial part of the defense, was this is good science. This is not religion, even if it may be consistent with people's religious views. It really has scientific content, and we're doing our student body a service by presenting it to them.
Okay. Well, what happened then? Once you, you know, what were the pivotal moments in this litigation?
I think there were sort of three key components at trial. One was, we put on a really substantial scientific case with biologists and paleontologists and philosophers of science who really explained how science is done and how the theory of evolution and its many facets has been developed, and contrasted that with...
Well, hold on. Can I interrupt you there, Eric?
Yes.
And this is as good a place as any. Tell us a little bit about that. We've heard about this thing called the theory of evolution. Is it just a theory? I mean, is it really that special? Is it really that accepted within the biology community?
You know, I think the first point is that when you use the term theory in science, as opposed to how we might use it, you know, sort of just in our ordinary conversation, theory is actually, you know, a description of a scientific proposition, which means it's very robust, based on many facts and tests and inferences. So, you know, while theory is sometimes derided as sort of it's used as a derogatory term when used about evolution, it's actually, when scientists talk about it, it's a very substantial concept, just like the theory of gravity or germ theory or atomic theory. Yes, it's incredibly well developed. I mean, what Darwin did back in the 1860s and everything he was able to explain was remarkable. But after Darwin's time, there has been so much confirmatory evidence, particularly in the genetic code, that he could never have, you know, been aware of or really imagined. But it has really bolstered his explanation of, of the development of species from lower forms. So it is, you know, within the scientific community, this isn't controversial. It's not a weak theory. There is just an incredible amount of evidence and testing and explanation that backs it up.
I think you might have just said this, but is there any substantial challenge within the scientific community, specifically the biology community, to this as being accepted, that it is the basic organizing principle of biology?
Absolutely not. I mean, there are arguments about how it happens. There are gaps, as there is in every scientific proposition, about everything that's happened. That's why, I mean, that's what makes it a great field for scientists, because they're constantly figuring out new things, but they are figuring out those new things. And so every day we learn more that confirms the theory, but within the scientific community, there isn't a controversy. It's a cultural controversy, but not a scientific controversy.
Okay, so that was the first part of your case then, was essentially showing the judge? This was a bench trial, incidentally, right?
Correct. It was no jury, just the bench trial.
Okay, just showing the judge of how evolution is supported within the scientific community?
Correct.
Okay.
And that sort of responds to the defense's argument that they were presenting valid science to the students. But, of course, for the Establishment Clause, you've really got to show that it's a religious proposition, and that it is akin to creationism, which courts have already ruled on. And the most powerful piece of evidence in that regard was the Pandas textbook itself. We were able to show that the book, which purported to be about intelligent design, had actually been drafted as a creationist textbook, with the words creationist and creationism found all throughout the book.
But wait a minute. Let me get clear on this. So of Pandas and People was written originally as a creationism book.
Correct.
And it had references to God and creationism in it?
Creationism was replete in it. I don't think there were references to God in it, but creationism and creationist, those terms were found throughout the book.
And then we
had drafts from the publisher. We subpoenaed drafts from the publisher, which showed that. And then in 1987, a new draft was prepared before it was ever published, in which creationism was substituted out and intelligent design was put in its place, like you would do a find and replace on your computer now.
That must have been a remarkable moment when you found that evidence.
Yes, and the timing is notable too, because 1987 was when the Supreme Court held that you couldn't teach creationism. So this was truly an example of evolutionary adaptation by the creationists. They changed because the legal environment changed.
I see. All right. So you've got the evidence now that you've already established that biology and has nothing to do with creationism. That, in other words, that evolution is very well accepted. So creationism is not science. And then you went on to show that this intelligent design theory being proposed by the school board was actually creationism in disguise. And the first major piece of evidence was this book that had been altered. What else did you find?
Intelligent design has been promoted by a think tank in Seattle called the Discovery Institute.
Right.
They're still very active. They're active supporting legislation that's being put forth in Tennessee right now. And this organization has a mission statement called the Wedge Document, which really depicts intelligent design as a cultural and religious project, which advocates scientific propositions that are consistent with Christian convictions. So, and there were many other writings by people in the intelligent design movement which showed their religious purpose. They have a facade of science, and some people in the intelligent design movement have written books that look like they're scientific. I think we were able to demonstrate they weren't, but they sort of have the trappings of science. But behind that, there's a lot of evidence that this is a religious and cultural project. And then the other piece of evidence to show this was a violation of the Constitution was the statements of the board members themselves. When they first started talking about alternatives to evolution, they talked in very religious terms. They talked about creationism at public school board meetings, and these were documented in newspaper reports. When we took their depositions, those board members denied that they had said all the religious statements about the biology curriculum that the newspapers had reported. And one of the things that occurred at trial, and I kind of feel like the nail in the board's coffin, so to speak, was showing that they were lying about what they had said, which really, had to raise questions about their credibility and their motives. And we were able to find videotape from news stories where they had actually talked about creationism. We were able to bring witnesses in to confirm that the newspaper reports were right. And the judge became visibly exasperated with what he described in his opinion as just flat-out lying.
Right. It was actually rather remarkable statement by a judge. That was John Jones, right?
Correct.
Now, was he one of those left-wing liberal Democrat judges we hear about?
Well, I think he's just a judge. I think there's a lot of misconceptions about whether it's left-wing liberal or, you know, right-wing conservative judges. I think most, maybe not all, but most judges really try to do their job, which is to decide cases impartially under the law. That's clearly what he did, and you know, he was happened to be appointed by President George W. Bush. He was.
Wait a minute. The judge in this case, who eventually ruled in your favor, was a George W. Bush appointee.
Correct.
Okay, I guess he wasn't one of those left-wing liberal judges then. He listened to this testimony, and he was visibly upset with the lies that the school board members.
Right, said. And there was a point with one of the board members where he actually continued the examination after our cross-examination was over to really find out why one of the board members, Alan Bonsell, had misled us at his deposition about how the Pandas books were paid for. And the judge ultimately concluded that Mr. Bonsell and another board member, Mr. Buckingham, were not telling the truth. He said that in his opinion, and he referred them to the U.S. attorney for perjury investigation after the trial.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say, as a lawyer, that when the judge starts cross-examining you, things are not going well in the courtroom.
It was a fairly, I've described it as a sort of Zeusian moment where you see sort of a judge who was pretty actually very, you know, he was very good-humored and relatively mild-mannered get visibly angry at a witness. And even though it was in our favor, I actually felt bad for the witness.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we've been talking to Eric Rothschild, one of the lawyers on the very important Dover case, in which a federal court considered intelligent design and whether it has any place in the high school curriculum. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to hear the end of this very exciting interview with Eric Rothschild. Stay tuned.
Published The Origin of Species by Natural Selection. A lot of people didn't want to be descended from apes. Come on.
Well, now we're going to go back and finish our discussion with Eric Rothschild, who was one of the co-lead counsels in the Kitzmiller versus Dover Area School District case. And we left it with a very dramatic recounting of some of the pivotal cross-examinations in that case.
There was one other rather pivotal cross-examination, if I recall correctly, and that was of the expert witness for the defense. Didn't they have a biologist on their side of the case who was insisting that there was some sort of scientific basis for intelligent design?
Right. So there's a professor from Lehigh University, a biochemist named Michael Behe. And, you know, before he got involved in intelligent design, he had done sort of standard biochemistry work, had published a lot. And then in 1996 published a book called Darwin's Black Box, which made what proponents of intelligent design think is the strongest scientific case for intelligent design, and it has to do with the complexity within the cell and an argument that couldn't have that complexity couldn't have developed through natural selection. And so,
now just a minute, I know that's a little bit technical, so let's make sure everyone is on the same page there. I believe it's called the concept of irreducible complexity.
That's right.
And the idea is that the evolution, the mechanisms of evolution, natural selection, could never construct something, for example, as complex as an eyeball.
He actually took it below the organ level and to the sort of biochemical level, but that's the general idea. Some of the examples he uses are the vertebrate immune system is an example that he uses that could not have come to do what it does through the steps of natural selection.
Because too many things would have had to happen simultaneously.
Correct.
And not gradually. Okay, that's the argument. Now, what did your expert say about that? How did you address that during your cross of Dr.
Behe? So we
both
called experts, and then you know, it was my job to cross-examine Professor Behe at trial. And you know, there's a number of components to the argument. And one is that, you know, even if Professor Behe was right, which, you know, I think persuasively demonstrated he was not. That's at most a critique of evolution. It doesn't show, it doesn't provide an explanation or a mechanism for how the vertebrate immune system did develop, or the blood clotting cascade, which is another one of his examples. It doesn't give any positive explanation, any mechanism. And Professor Behe acknowledged he could not identify the mechanism, so it's effectively just, it happened. So that's a component of it. It really relies, in a sense, then on having some, again, supernatural explanation, which is really outside science. And then our experts demonstrated that, you know, all the examples he gave, in fact, have sound natural explanations for how they occurred. The vertebrate immune system being a good example, it's actually been incredibly well studied, and the mechanism and of how the vertebrate immune system has developed from more primitive forms to, you know, the fairly well operating system that we have. There's tons of evidence and. Explanation.
If I can interrupt you, sure. I believe, in fact, that didn't you, at a certain point, simply start stacking up the various studies that that discredited Dr. Behe's commentary?
Right, and
right there on the witness stand, right?
Yes, and I've been accused of being theatrical in doing that by just, you know, sort of piling them up like it was. You know, the letters to Santa Claus and Miracle on the 34th Street. And, you know, I plead guilty that it was a demonstrative way to show the court how much evidence there was. And you know, Professor Behe sort of dismissed all of that as being inadequate, which, you know, I thought was a real insult to scientists who actually have done all this work, whereas, you know, on the other side, there's really none of this kind of testing or writing in support of intelligent design.
Very interesting. So Dr. Behe cited several examples of what he thought were so-called irreducible complexity.
Right.
You came up with studies, a number of studies that had looked at the very examples he gave and come and demonstrated how natural selection could have produced them.
Correct.
And his response was simply to say that he wasn't convinced by them.
Correct. That none of them were detailed enough. So, you know, you would literally, I mean, from what I gathered from him, you would literally have to chart every step from the beginning of biological history through the present to satisfy his standard.
That was a dramatic moment, just like Miracle on 34th Street. And what happened then? What was the resolution of the trial? What exactly happened after all the testimony was given?
So, you know, the trial went for 6 weeks, and then the judge took the matter under advisement. We submitted post-trial papers describing each side, describing what we thought the evidence showed. And then about 6 weeks later, I think it was December 20th, the judge issued his opinion, and you know, he had let us know it was coming. And so our legal team and some of our experts gathered at my firm's Harrisburg office to wait for the result. And, you know, it just comes by email. It was a long opinion, 140 pages, and the judge, you know, ruled in our favor in sort of all respects that intelligent design was a religious concept, that it's not scientific, and that the board members were acting out of a religious purpose when they added it to their curriculum.
So I believe the technical legal term for such an opinion is a slam dunk.
We said grand slam, but
dunk, same sort of thing.
It was a very exciting day as we read through the opinion, and then made even better as our clients came into the office to join us to celebrate. That's a great feeling. You've probably had it when, you know, it was a personal victory and a victory for the issue. But the best part of it is when you sort of see your clients and they feel vindicated and happy about the work you've done, and that was. It's just an incredible feeling.
What was the opinion? Did the school board appeal the opinion?
They did not, actually, because, and you know, I think they're related events, that most of the proponents of intelligent design, the biology curriculum, who were up for election that fall were voted out of office, and the new board determined not to appeal.
I see. So this opinion still stands. In fact, if my understanding is correct, this is the only case in all of the United States to go to this length and actually have a full-length trial with a full evidentiary hearing and all of the protections that go into a trial, the procedural protections, that to actually squarely address this issue of intelligent design. Have there been any other cases of this magnitude in this area?
Not. I mean, there had been previously with creation science in the 80s, but this is really the only case that has delved into the issue of intelligent design in this nature.
Remarkable. What? How would you answer a critic that says that somehow this is an anti-religious case, or that the plaintiffs here were simply against God?
First of all, the parents we represented as plaintiffs, in terms of their own religious beliefs, ran the gamut. There's some who are not religious at all, and some who are very religious. One couple who runs a vacation Bible class. I mean,
Wait a minute. Some of the Kitzmiller plaintiffs were practicing Christians who run Bible classes?
Yes. They had, the exact kind of diversity you expect in any community. As I said, not all were religious, but some were very much so. That was true of our legal team, our expert team, the teachers at the Dover High School who were opposed to the intelligent design policy. A couple of them were children of ministers. So at least from, their standpoint, this certainly wasn't anti-religious. And we look at this case as actually a case for religious freedom. There's actually a sort of a great diversity of religious belief on the issue of origins. Most mainstream denominations accept the theory of evolution as a sound scientific proposition and not inconsistent with their religious beliefs. So this was really just imposing, a sectarian religious view, honestly held by some people, which, is fine as a matter of religious view, but it was imposing this sectarian view on all of the students who, represented a diversity of religious beliefs. So we think, keeping that sectarian view outside the public school classroom and free to be shared as parents and clergy leaders see fit in other environments, in the home, in the church, synagogue, mosque, what have you, it's actually, the best result for religious freedom.
So this case doesn't say that you doesn't affect what people believe or what they do in church or in their homes, does it?
Correct. And I think there's just a misconception that the theory of evolution is, pro-atheist, anti-religious. It's science. It doesn't take a position on religion, the existence of God at all.
I've sometimes heard that sentiment expressed as evolution tells us the how, but not the who.
Right.
In fact, I'm aware that there are many religions that believe that in a theistic evolution, that there is a God and that God created everything and that the particular mechanism that God used to create us and create everything around us, all living things, was evolution.
Right. And we had experts who felt that way, not as a scientific proposition, but as their religious belief.
Very interesting. Well, Eric Rothschild, I really appreciate your time. You've been very, very helpful today. And any concluding thoughts?
No, I appreciate being on the show. I hope people in communities outside Pennsylvania who maybe have to confront this issue, think hard about trying to incorporate it into public school education and make sure that science education is, remains strong in its proper sphere.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to Eric Rothschild of Pepper Hamilton in Philadelphia. What a great interview that was, all about his exploits in the Dover case. Thanks also to my former student, Jason Grace, telling us, giving us all the background about this case, putting it in context for us. Thanks to our distribution engineers, Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Thanks also to our scheduler, Carol Hutchinson. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.